Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, and I'm really glad to have her back, is Mindy Johnson. She's an award-winning author and historian, and we're continuing our conversation about her books, Ink and Paint, The Woman of Walt Disney's Animation, and Disney Pencils, Pens, and Brushes, A Great Girl's Guide to Disney Animation. Mindy, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again.
Oh, thanks, Mark. Great to be back.
We had to talk more about this book. You have so much stuff in this book that if we did like 10 interviews, we would still be barely scratching the surface. So if people want to know the history of the Disney studio, this is the book to go to. Talking about women in Disney's life, two people we didn't mention who were right there from the beginning, Lillie and Edna, who were they?
Well, Lillian Bounds was actually one of the earliest employees of the Disney Brothers Studios. She was the sister of a neighbor in the area, Hazel Sewell. Hazel was the oldest of the Bounds family kids, had a large family, about 10 kids, I think. And Hazel had moved to Southern California, to Los Angeles, with her husband then, Glenn, and their daughter, Marjorie. And shortly after finishing her training, her college training in secretarial skills, her youngest sister, Lillian, came out to Los Angeles for a new adventure in life. And Hazel had said, well, you know, there's some hiring going on. And Hazel actually introduced Walt and Roy to their first employee, which was a woman. Her name was Kathleen Dollard. And Kathleen was this fun little bubbly sprite gal who was doing a little bit of everything, all hands on deck for the tiny little studio of just the three.
Wow.
Initially. And and she was essentially there as a blackener, which was filling in the lines that were drawn to show up on camera, and blackening in the areas that required blackening in, hence the term blackener. And she was quite a good cook and had a fun, bubbly personality. And I have it on very accurate authority from her family that a very young Walt Disney proposed to her, but she turned him down because she didn't think he'd amount to anything.
Yeah, and I never bought that Xerox stock either.
No.
Oh, man.
You know, Kathleen was, you know, with her friend Hazel and Hazel's younger sister, Lillian, and said, well, you know, they're looking for people where I'm working, but don't vamp the boss, meaning I'm kind of seeing him, but, you know, I don't know if it'll, you know, just don't be interested. And so Lillian didn't even think anything about that. She went and met with Walt. She wasn't very impressed because he was in pretty rumpled clothing and was kind of scattered and, but she took the job because it was only a couple of blocks away, so she didn't have to worry about buses or transportation. I think she could walk to and from the office. Well, she started working as a blackener, and the little studio was expanding, and then they moved to a storefront. And soon Walt could afford a car, so he was driving the ladies, Kathleen and Lillian, home. And Lillian figured something was up when he would drop Kathleen off first, who was further away and in the opposite direction.
It's amazing how much that's still a ploy.
But she began to sort of see him as, oh, okay, there's, you know, this guy has a sense of things and there's something there. And so she really was there from the earliest, from the very beginning, as was Hazel, her sister. And
wow.
I think Walt really enjoyed it. It was always a vibrant household when he asked Lily if he could, you know, court her. And
wow.
Once he got a suit, and then he would come and Hazel made these incredible chicken dinners. And
oh, so, man.
They, you know, he just sort of loved the whole vibrant family sense that was there. And Lillian was a very, you know, sweet and exacting. She worked briefly as a secretary. And then after they were married, she continued to help out. And really were Edna and Lillian. Edna knew Walt back in Kansas City. That's where she met Roy. And they were steadies, went steady. And Roy just decided, okay, it's time for us to get married. He telegraphed her and sent her a telegram and said, okay, it's time for us to get married. So she and her mother came out, and it was at a time when the Young Studio was really pushing with the early Oswalds and had found some level of success. But at the time of the earliest Mickey and Minnie cartoons, it's Edna and Lillian, who are sitting at their kitchen table working into the wee hours, blackening in, wow, you know, over 12,000 wow cells in secret to make, jeez, that animation work. And endless dinners late at night.
Wow.
You know, rarely, you know, kind of being on hand, rarely. See, they made a lot of sacrifices very early on and were right there in the throes of getting these films made. And too often they're overlooked as simply the Mrs. Disneys, and yet their hands were right there in the sandbox making that happen.
They never received any credits in the films, right? Obviously.
No, no. And, you know, again, that's the 1920s,
yeah,
30s
right
mentality. And there were a number of people who didn't get credit either. You know, credits were kind of a arbitrary thing, and the tradition wasn't that you, wow, put everybody on there. You just only top line people and or key certain people. It was also a perk for, you know, various areas of expertise, and there was a bit of a minimal standard there. So
a lot of people don't realize that one of Disney's earliest silent series starred a live action woman.
In fact, his very first would be Virginia Davis in the early Alice comedies. Now, there was a very popular cartoon of the day, the Coco the Clown series, and coming out of Fleischer Studios.
Right, right.
And it was an animated character in a real world. And so Walt felt, okay, let's take that a step further and put a real character in an animated world. And so his choice was a young girl. He had seen her. Virginia had done various little ads in the Kansas City area. And so he thought she had the personality and the charm, which, of course, she did. And so he created his first approach with that, but then ran out of money. He had sent it off to a woman, Margaret Winkler, in New York. She was operating as M.J. Winkler. She put a fictitious J to her name and operated in sort of the gender-neutral role as M.J. Winkler. And but she was the first woman in the Producers Guild and a powerhouse, a real trailblazer in distribution, particularly for animation. In fact, I firmly believe it's quite clear we owe where we are today with animation to her.
That's right.
She is
That's
the
right.
one who gave Walt Disney his start. She would coach him, and he was listening. Very early on in his earliest Alice comedy series, he appreciated her insights and experience and what she was conveying to him, and he took it to heart and applied it to the films and kind of looked to her in terms of a mentor early on. And the Alice comedies, as a result, became another part of the novelties that were out right there at the time.
We're going to skip around because otherwise we'll never get anywhere because I could listen to you all day. I want to skip around to the late 30s and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. People have no idea what a revolutionary concept the two a full-length feature animation. There were people who were saying that your mind couldn't take it in, that you would go mad if you watched a full-length animation. And Disney did it. Now, there were many women involved, and we'll talk about, but one of the more important was the production secretary, Bea Selk. Is that how you pronounce her name?
Bea Selk, yeah, absolutely.
She was in charge of keeping track of everything.
Yeah, and on a production that had never been done to that scale before.
Oh, my God.
So now there were a couple of examples, just to be clear. There were a couple of feature-length animated films in different forms. There was a hand-drawn piece out of Argentina, but sadly there are no known copies of it.
Oh.
Everything was destroyed in a fire, but it was not to the length or, you know, we just don't know. But Lottie Reiniger, almost 10 years prior to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, had created The Adventures of Prince Achmed.
And it's a beautiful, that's a stunning animation for people who have not seen it, but it's a shadow animation. It's done with cutouts.
Yeah, shadow puppetry. And she was so innovative with developing the multi-plane approach and many other things that she's not as widely known or as taught in coursework as Walt Disney or others. And she really deserves
absolutely.
To be placed into the pantheon of. And her work had to have had some lasting effect, but it was a different approach. So, indeed, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is the first surviving hand-rendered, two-dimensional animated film. And a landmark, to be sure, because the approach is entirely different. And the artistry, the level of artistry is still, in many ways, unsurpassed. You will never see any kind of production along those lines again. I would say maybe Loving Vincent might come close, but it really, which is a recent film that viewers should see and explore the production process of that film. But Snow White was such a, you know, it may as well be, I'm going to snowshoe across the plains on Venus. It's such an impossibility that, Walt was laughed and sort of ostracized a little bit.
Well, people called it Disney's folly. Before it was released, people called it Disney's folly. They didn't.
Yeah. And if you think about it, in many ways, yes, there were beliefs that it would hurt your eyes, that you'd go blind or would go crazy because of watching too much color. But you have to remember, you have the advent of three-strip Technicolor. Prior to that, it was two-strip Technicolor, which was, and other color processes in Hollywood, which were, the two-strip approach was a real heavy greens and reds. So it's very hard to watch. There are films, King of Jazz, which was Bing Crosby's debut film. There's an animated sequence in there, and it was hard to watch. Audiences, it was exciting that it was color, but it was still very hard to watch. And so not knowing what this would be or the extent to the level of artistry that Walt would pursue, those who were a bit short-sighted were making very public comments like that. And it's easier for us to look back and say, oh, yeah, isn't that crazy? But you have to, again, consider these things with gentle eyes and recognize that if it hadn't been done before, it was not within anybody's realm of comprehension necessarily outside of Walt Disney himself. Even the artists that worked on it really didn't have a sense of the final vision that Walt conveyed to them years prior. Ollie Johnston and Frank Thomas have said, we didn't think we could do a feature-length animated film.
Well, you quote the amount of cells used for the final film, 362,000 cells, 43,922 total hours of work, and just for the ink and painting, again, mostly done by women, 1,500 shades of paint had to be developed for this. Now, there's an interesting aspect of this. Because it's during the talking period now, they had to sort of cast around to find the right voice for Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
And it fell to Adriana Caselotti?
Correct, yes.
And this brings... go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No,
she really was a young talent and was eager because this was the buzz around Hollywood. And Walt, you have to remember, had this established, this world-renowned reputation. Mickey Mouse was in every home. And, many people thought, well, why are you pushing further? Rest on your laurels. And the Silly Symphonies were a standard part of the film-going experience as well. But so that was added to the puzzlement by many on why Walt was doing what he was doing. But Adriana, there was quite an interesting search for her. Walt always cast his voices by ear. He would never look at the women or the men. He wanted to let his ears do the leading on that. And so she actually, there was a phone call initially, and then there were auditions where Walt would listen in from another part of the studio. He could listen in at his audience from the soundstage. So if they were doing dialogue tests on or casting for different voices, which I think was quite wise. And she sort of delivered. She had came from an operatic background as a young girl and could bring her voice to a higher pitch, and she got the part.
Jeez. Now, I want to mention that that becomes another job in animation, vocal talent. And and the reason I mention this is the introduction to your book, Ink and Paint, was written by June. She is one of my heroes, June Foray. Yeah. And can we just say a few things about June Foray?
Oh, absolutely. How can we not? You know, I think what really is so succinctly determined describes June Foray is Chuck Jones's great quote about, and if your audiences may be familiar with the great Mel Blanc, who was also sort of the renowned voice, had 1,000 voices and is so rampant all throughout Hollywood. He did so much, and not only Warner Brothers, he did some Disney voices. He did a lot of radio and television later on.
He was on Jack Benny a lot.
Yeah, so he really had a presence and was known, but I think Chuck wisely stated, June Foray is not the female Mel Blanc. Mel Blanc is the male June Foray.
People are probably going to remember her for Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Natasha Nogoodnick and also Rocky J. Squirrel.
Yeah. No, she was a voice that we all grew up with. In fact, that's the name of her lovely, sweet autobiography, Did You Grow Up With Me Too? She really was the voice of generations, plural. She, you've heard her voice in so many things. She was... Witch Hazel was sort of this tour de force character. She could do anything. She was so versatile and would do so many things. She was so supportive of student works. Many students would approach her, and absolutely, she was always there. She was always punctual or ahead of time. She was always professional. She knew her stuff. She stood about 4 feet tall. She was this tiny little mite, and yet she was a powerhouse in this industry. We owe the best animated picture category at the Academy, at the Oscars, to June Foray. She also started ASIFA and the Animation Guild. So where we are structurally, and she laid the groundwork for this industry in so many landmark ways that, and sadly, no one knows that. So when it came time to put the definitive foreword on this book, there was a very short list.
Oh, wow.
And a couple of very tough gets, but I reached out, and I'd known June for years, but her health was failing at this point. And so I'd reached out, and yes, the answer came back, yes, absolutely. So we pieced this together based on her interviews and what she had done, and we were able to get it. Her blessing on it. It was the last official thing she did before she passed.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight. Always a pleasure to talk to her. Mindy Johnson, award-winning author and historian. And we're continuing our conversation about two of her books, Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animations, and in a completely different way, but overlaps somewhat, Disney Pencils, Pens, and Brushes, A Great Girl's Guide to Disney Animation. As we mentioned last, it's ostensibly written for a younger audience, but trust me, adults will love it too. One thing I want to talk about, and it's an interesting part of your book, was the infamous Disney studio strike, which happened in 1941. Mm-hmm. What was the strike about?
Well, you have to go back a little bit in that. There had been other strikes and other union issues and throughout the animation industry at this time. Virtually every other animation house had finally unionized, and Walt had built his studio up from the ground. It was his baby, and he felt, and in many ways, yes, that studio was, they called it the resort or the country club, because the conditions were stellar. The, you know, everything was put back into fostering and building great quality work. There were a number of issues that came about. There were a number of things that have added to it. By moving into the Burbank Studios, Walt built the state-of-the-art studio, the only studio in Hollywood and in animation built specifically for animation at the time. And he spent quite a bit of that money. I think there were still some artists felt that with the success of Snow White, they felt they should be seeing bonuses back independently rather than putting it towards a new facility to keep the industry going, to keep their jobs going. Pay was the big concern, and so people were, there was some question on whether some of the rates were underinflated or undervalued or overinflated. But it was a confusing time, very frustrating.
You have some interviews with women who were involved in the strike, and one of them, I think it was Grace Godino, organized by all the wrong people. The strike, and it was very bitter, and it really split up a lot of friendships.
It sure did. You have roommates. There's the Ruthie Thompson story in there of one roommate dropping off her roommate to go run in the picket line while the other one crossed the line. It split families up. It split friendships up. It was very divisive. And so the other studios joined in and union members joined in. It was very colorful. It was but it was devastating for families going for months and months without work through the bulk of the summer of 1941. So Walt, it was hard. People that he had known from very early on at the studio and were part of what built the studio were suddenly on the outside while he was on the inside, and they were still trying to keep the studio going. So you have the production of Dumbo happening literally with all hands on deck for those who did cross and were there at the studio. And many felt, look, we've worked so hard. We owe this to Walt. Why would you question? Why would you challenge? He's treated us well. Other studios, that was not the case. And so there was, but there, you have a little bit of mafia stuff going on, thugs. There were people scratching cars and, ready to throw punches if necessary. And it got a little scary at times as well, very heated. And I think it really devastated a lot of people and lingered for many, many years. I knew as I was approaching that subject, I wanted to get as many firsthand accounts as possible and to let them tell their stories behind it. And thankfully, the studio and the publishing teams said, yes, we leave it as is. It's all in there. And so nothing sugar-coated.
We're almost out of time, believe it or not. And we barely started. What's amazing is as the Disney empire sort of expands into Disneylands and on television, you talk about all the women involved. Disneyland is amazing. Ruth, is it Shellhorn, who is the landscape architect that worked on Disneyland? Is it Shellhorn? And then you have people designing the puppets for Pirates of the Caribbean. I think that's Liotta Toombs. And women, the great thing is to uncover these women and show them at work in your book. It's just they're the unsung heroes who've made these things happen. It's absolutely stunning. And then even on TV, there's Annette. I grew up with the Disney Mickey Mouse Club, and I remember Annette really, really well as everybody else. And the point is that in every step, women were part of the mix and
absolutely,
an important, a crucial part of the mix in a lot of the times.
Absolutely. And from the very beginning, you know, when we look back at our collective past, we're really only getting half the story.
Oh, yeah.
History is, as I think I mentioned before, written, recorded, preserved, and archived from a male perspective. And it was a real concerted effort. It was that much more challenging to find these women or their families because nothing has really been documented. Nothing has been held or preserved.
Well, the amazing thing is the amount of photographs that are in your book.
Yeah.
Is it because it was Disney Studios, though, and because they were so involved in documentation of everything that there were that many photographs of all the particular people involved?
Yes. To a point, but there were also other women. I think it speaks really to truly how progressive Walt was. It was really about your talent and your artistry, not your hair color or shoe size. And he had, at the height of all of the Snow White, in fact, it was a woman publicist who was behind the worldwide campaign of Snow White, which was a groundbreaking publicity campaign.
Right.
Janet Martin was a real, again, trailblazer in how we experience and promote animation. And she took it upon herself to really tell the story that, you know, women are working at Disney. There are these wonderful articles and photographs and interviews that were done at the hand of Janet Martin, who made that happen. Now, in the 1930s, how many women were working in Hollywood? There were more than what people realized. We just have failed to document that because we focus unconsciously on the male. And so it was a real challenge to, A, find them, but they're there. And I sort of throw the gauntlet out there to historians and others as you move through your world and look into our collected past to look for the women, find where the women were.
And a great example, we're completely out of time.
Out.
A great example is to look at ink and paint, because that shows you how it can be done. My returning guest tonight is Mindy Johnson, award-winning author and historian. And we've been continuing our conversation about her groundbreaking book, Ink and Paint, The Woman of Walt Disney's Animation, and Disney's Pencils, Pens, and Brushes, A Great Girl's Guide to Disney Animation. Both books are wonderful. The definitive history, though, of women at Disney is Ink and Paint. It's an incredible, incredible volume to read. Mindy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, a great joy. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.